Noam Chomsky is here. He is a political activist. He is a writer and is a professor at MIT. He has written exclusively and lectured around the world on linguistics, philosophy, and politics. He is widely credited with having revolutionized modern linguistics. He is the author of numerous books, including American Power and the New Mandarins, and also 9/11. Here is Hegemony or Survival, his newest book. I am pleased to have him on this program for many reasons, including the fact that I get more emails about please have Mr. Chomsky on this program than anyone could ever imagine. How do you explain this phenomenal connection between you and certainly an audience of people who are user-friendly with the Internet?
Well, I think people who are... There's an enormous number of people who are involved in a informal, disorganized, activist, dissident culture, and they tend to make their own connections outside the major institutional channels, which are not hospitable to them. And the Internet has been has become a major form of interconnection, organizing, not just in the United States, everywhere. I mean, in South Korea, for example, they recently elected a president using the Internet for organizing and communication and getting around the strong opposition of the media and the concentrated power to the popular candidates. It happens to be a very wired up society.
Well, it is. Broadband, I think, has a higher penetration in South Korea, perhaps more than any other country except Singapore.
But it's happened everywhere. I mean, let's take, say, Indonesia.
Yeah.
When the Suharto dictatorship was overthrown in 1998, a lot of the organizing, a lot of it was student activism, and it was a very harsh, brutal society, but they did succeed through Internet interconnections to organize political actions, demonstrations, other activities, and it was a major factor leading to the overthrow of the dictatorship.
Well, Howard Dean, I suspect, would say that one of the primary reasons he had been able to get to this commanding position in the Democratic race for the presidency is the Internet, allowing him both to communicate and to raise money.
Yeah. It's had, I mean, it's a sort of a, can also be a lethal instrument, but...
Lethal in what way?
Well, I'm sure you get, I don't want to guess how many emails you get, but it can be overwhelming. Even a lot of material that one of the problems with the Internet, I mean, it's the good part of it is it's free and open.
Right, exactly.
But, of course, that has a downside. That means that things go up that have no review
and they,
or support.
And they, clog the system.
They clog the system. And so it's a mixture. But it certainly has been an extremely effective way of allowing people to participate actively in everything from industrial societies to very repressive societies. So take, say, the World Social Forum, which is a huge enterprise, 100,000 people last year. It's mostly Internet organized. There's just no other means of intercommunication among highly diverse people. Most of them are somewhat, out of the power centers in their own societies. And this provides them a means of organizing, exchanging information, interaction. It gives them access to a far wider range of sources of information and analysis than they would get by picking up the newspapers at the newsstand, and that has major effect.
Do you think regimes around the world ought to be frightened of the possibilities of the Internet?
I'm sure they are, including our own government. Since the Internet was, like most modern technology, it came out of the state system.
Right.
We have a lot of the economy relies on a dynamic state sector. The Internet was developed...
in the Pentagon or somewhere.
Well, it was, actually places like MIT.
Right.
But it came out of Pentagon funding and the Advanced Research Project Agency, the Pentagon, about in the early 60s.
Right.
And it remained inside the state system until the mid-90s. I think 1995 it was privatized. And since then, it's changed. I mean, before that, it was considered, in fact, it was called usually an information highway. After that, it's mostly called e-commerce.
Right.
And the character of it changed. But there has been a lot of concern in power centers all over the world that it's just too free and open. And the question is, how can you shape it and modify it so as to lead people in preferred directions, you know, away from, say, organizing the World Social Forum.
Exactly. Yeah. What, for example, are the Chinese doing about it? Do you know?
In China, I think internet access is quite restricted.
That's what I thought.
And highly censored. I don't know how much even limited access there is, but it's a very hard medium to control.
Exactly.
You know, once people have access, they can do all sorts of things. So the means of controlling it that are being considered, as far as I understand, are mostly trying to lead people in particular directions. So that you, when you enter an internet portal, you know, you'll be sort of drawn off this way.
Drawn here, rather that way. Okay.
Yeah. Right. And therefore you'll have the
rather
ideas.
Than opening up, it'll take you somewhere.
And the idea is you'll have to use, you know, energy and initiative and commitment and what you're looking for if you want to go in the directions less preferred by power centers, which is, it's a terrain of struggle right now. There's a lot of pressure from popular and activist groups to make it, leave it entirely open, not controlled.
If you were, if this would be your last day on Earth.
Not that far from it.
Well, you're, what, 75?
Yeah.
Would you like what's said about you to be your political arguments or your contribution to the theory of linguistics?
Tell you the honest truth, I really don't care.
You don't care.
I mean, I'd like to see people follow up on the things that are interesting and important and productive and forget about the things that were byways and mistakes and so on. But if my name is attached to it or not,
well, would you characterize as most important in your judgment, if you were?
Well, I mean, I played a certain role in reshaping the fields concerned with human intellectual faculties, cognitive sciences, right. In particular linguistics. Some of it has been extremely productive. Not me, it's a cooperative enterprise. And that's often running on its own.
Right.
In the political domain, I would like to see people energized, participating, thinking for themselves, not subordinating themselves to systems of discipline and propaganda, either in the structure of life, and there's plenty of that, or in the doctrinal domains. So if people can come to use the capacities that they in fact have and the opportunities they in fact have to overcome systems of authority, illegitimate authority, domination, hierarchy, free themselves, think through issues for themselves, not the way they're taught to conform, and do something about it. That's the best legacy I can imagine.
As I said to you when you said that, I know nothing about linguistics. One of many subjects I know nothing about, but especially linguistics. Is there one question in the air in that whole realm, though, that you would like most to know the answer to?
Well, like everyone, I have my own personal quirks. And yes, there are some questions which are...
big mega questions.
There are mega questions which are on the border of research. You can't really... They're a little beyond what you can study very much. You can pick away at them. But, one kind of question, which is a sort of a personal obsession, is that if you look at any language is a biological system.
Right.
It's part of it's like our immune system, right. Or visual system, just something humans have. It's highly specific to humans. There don't seem to be any counterparts elsewhere in nature.
You're in New York because of our mutual friend Edward Said, who passed away a month or so ago, correct? Yeah, and you... Tell me, just because you're here, your sense of... What would you most want to say in appreciation of him?
Well, Edward was an old friend. We were very close friends for years. We had a lot of mutual interests.
Would that be culture, music, politics?
Culture, politics, mainly political interests, including his prime concern, also a major concern of mine, Middle East, but
right.
Much broader questions of justice, freedom, oppression, which he was much involved in. Me too, and our paths often crossed. And then it was just a close personal friendship. Actually, he had arranged, we've never talked about this much, but back in the, I guess it must have been around 20 years ago or 25 years ago, he began arranging with meetings between high officials in the Palestine Liberation Organization when they were visiting New York, meetings with friends of his who were sympathetic to the Palestinians, critical of the PLO, to see if there could be some constructive discussion to suggest ways in which they could change what they're doing to achieve results which would make more sense for the people involved. And I was involved in some of those meetings.
Anything come out of it?
No. I have to say no.
What do you think of the Geneva Accord that they've been working on?
Current Geneva Accord.
Yes, exactly.
Well, it offers
better than
some
they
real hope.
Yeah.
It's a great improvement over the Camp David proposals, which were completely unacceptable.
Back to the Palestinians?
Yeah, they made no sense.
You know, Jimmy Carter said that today.
Did he?
On a recent appearance on this program.
Oh, really? Well, he's quite right. And as soon as you look at a map of what was proposed, you see that it was absolutely unacceptable. I mean, it broke up the... Now, there's a lot of talk about percentages and so on. That didn't mean a thing. If you looked at the actual maps that were discussed, which unfortunately were not easily available in the United States, they should have been, but they weren't. As soon as you look at the maps, you see that what an effect it did was break the West Bank into three pretty separate cantons.
So these were not contiguous territories?
Well, they were technically contiguous, but only way around the edges. If you wanted to go from Bethlehem to Ramallah, you were going to have to go way to the east. And So the three effectively separated territories, all, again, effectively separated from a little part of East Jerusalem, which is the center of, traditional center of Palestinian cultural, educational, commercial existence. And it was a kind of a Bantustan situation, as was discussed in Israel at the time. And of course, it was all separated from Gaza. Well, you know, that's... Actually, the meaning of that was described by President Barak's
right.
chief negotiator, Shlomo Ben-Ami.
Right. And later, foreign minister.
Yeah, and he was the negotiator at Camp David,
right.
And he was an academic, and shortly before he entered the government, he wrote a book about it in Hebrew in which he said the goal of the whole Oslo process and leading to this would be what he called a permanent neo-colonial dependency. The Palestinians would be a neo-colonial, effectively modern colonial dependency permanently. And in fact, that's what the proposal was. And it couldn't work. However, after the Camp David proposals broke down, this is now August, September 2000, that's when the current Intifada started. But negotiations continued. And they... I made some progress. In January 2001, there were meetings in Taba, which led to informal meetings, but with fairly high-level people on both sides. And they made considerable progress towards a more acceptable two-state settlement.
But it was too late then because the Israelis were into their election.
They were into the election campaign, and Prime Minister Barak canceled the meetings, and after Sharon was elected and the violence began to escalate, they were never picked up. Everyone assumed, I assumed too, that they were never continued. However, it turns out now we've learned that contacts did continue, and the Geneva Accords that you mentioned are the results of these continuing contacts, and they are they make considerable progress beyond the Taba.
The Geneva Accords hammered out by Moshe Bellon and other Israelis in over 2 years with
Palestinians,
who I'm not sure, in part may have been members of the Palestinian Authority or not. I don't know.
Had been, but all are close to it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're as close to the center of Palestinian. Palestinians don't have a state, so they have an informal authority. But they were as close to the central part of it as the Israeli negotiators were to the Israeli government, in fact, probably closer. You know?
Your friend, the late Edward Said, didn't have much to say good about Yasser Arafat.
No. Nor did I.
Nor do you.
No. In fact, we were very much in accord about this for a long time.
But a real disservice to the Palestinians.
Well, it's I don't think one can say that exactly.
Why is that?
Because he's also a symbol. Without him as a
I'm
symbol
asking,
of
I'm
Palestinian...
I'm not making a statement, I'm asking.
Yeah.
So,
look, he remained a symbol of Palestinian nationality, struggle, refusal to submit. That's important.
Right.
I mean, whatever you may think of him personally, just serving the role of enabling people to resist harsh oppression, probable destruction, which was the goal. That's significant, whatever you think about his particular decisions and choices. And of those, they're a mixture. So I wouldn't, I mean, I was always harshly critical. You look at what I wrote back in the 60s, it was critical. Nevertheless, there's a strain which was on the right track. So in the mid-1970s, Arafat did recognize that the settlement would have to be a two-state political settlement. There was a Security Council resolution debated in January 1976, which was supported by the PLO. They publicly supported it, which called for a two-state settlement on the international border with full recognition of Israel's rights to peace and security and so on and so forth. That was a good resolution. Unfortunately, the U.S. vetoed it. And then there was a process for a number of years in which Arafat, in his complicated way, of which there's much to criticize, nevertheless, one theme that ran through it was trying to press for such a settlement. The reason Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982 was to try to prevent these efforts at diplomacy to continue. In fact, they said so publicly. It was an invasion to secure the West Bank.
The invasion of Lebanon.
Yeah, which is where the Palestinian PLO was based.
Right.
And they wanted to destroy it was called, and by the high command, in fact, a war for the West Bank. We have to stop the negotiations and the diplomacy, which was becoming an embarrassment. And let's get back to terror. They're happier with that. And this continued for some years, and it's a sort of a mixture of corruption, terror, violence, bad judgment, and a continuing drive towards what has to be, what almost the entire world recognized must be some kind of political settlement roughly along the international border with two states side by
roughly
side.
Along the 63 borders.
67
borders. 67 borders.
Roughly,
yeah.
With some modifications.
Yeah. How do you...
Actually, I should add, and we should be willing to recognize this, the main reason this has not taken place is that the U.S. has blocked it for 30 years, unilaterally.
How so?
Well, as I said, it vetoed the 1976 resolution.
Right.
It vetoed another Security Council resolution in 1980. It has,
at the behest of the Israelis or independently?
No, well, you know, we could argue about exactly why, but
right.
It did it. Israel didn't like it, but they could never have blocked it if the U.S. hadn't backed it.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, much more importantly, the U.S. provided the means, the diplomatic, military, and economic support, which enabled Israel to continue slowly integrating the territories effectively within Israel, the big settlement programs, the infrastructure programs, and they can't do it without U.S. support, and that's true right this minute.
They could not?
They can't do it without U.S. support, and they know it.
U.S. support in terms of in the international community or U.S. support at the U.N., for example?
At every level.
In other words, you're suggesting that without the U.S., the overlooming possible veto at the Security Council or in some other way, that there would be some kind of what?
No, they'd be blocked.
Some kind of Arab reaction militarily without the U.S.
They can't stand. No small country can stand alone against a unified international community. It's just impossible. There are all kinds of ways of stopping them, and they need the economic support and the military support.
That's a nice segue to Iraq, but I want to come back to other things.
Well, you know, and Israel has become. Actually, it goes back before 1976. In 1971. That's where the real split between the United States and the world begins on this. In 1971, the president of Egypt, new president of Egypt, the President Sadat, offered Israel a full peace treaty in return for withdrawal from Egyptian territory. Said nothing about the West Bank, nothing about the Palestinians. a full peace treaty recognizing, incorporating the main UN resolution 242, so the right to live in peace and security and so on and so forth, everything. Nothing about the refugees, just in return for withdrawal from Egyptian territory. Israel discussed it. They knew that it was a possible... We have internal records and others. Actually, Yossi Beilin wrote a... His doctoral dissertation was in Hebrew about revealing a lot of the records and cabinet records and other discussions about this. But it was also in the public record. Now, they had discussed the question, should they accept it? Now, they had a choice, and it was a fateful choice. The choice was to accept peace with Egypt. It's the main military force, which would essentially end the military conflict. There were no other major Arab military forces. So accept peace with Egypt, have a still retain control of the occupied territories, have to do something about it.
Because it wasn't on the table.
Wasn't on the table. And integrate themselves somehow into the region. That was one choice. The other choice was to insist on expansion. And the crucial expansion at that time was not the West Bank. It was northeastern Sinai, Egyptian territory. They wanted to expand into northeastern Sinai. And there were big developments there, driving Bedouins out of their homes. And they were building a city, in fact, an old Jewish city in northeastern Sinai. That was a choice. That, if they made the second choice, as they did, that entailed dependency on the United States because there was going to be a situation of permanent conflict. And that was the choice that was made. I think it was a very bad mistake.
But my impression was, and I'm, again, my impression was that in fact, when we had the agreement between Egypt...
1978.
Yeah. Well, 7 years later. Essentially, the agreement was that the Israelis withdrew, and in fact, Ariel Sharon came in and cleaned up the settlements.
Well, no, in northeastern Sinai.
Right.
Yeah. But
am I right about that or wrong?
That's correct. Okay. Yeah. But that's only half the story. By 1977, what happened in 71 is the offer was made, Israel rejected it. The crucial question is, what would the United States do? Well, there was an internal debate in the United States, and it was won by Henry Kissinger, whose view was, as he described it, that we should keep to what he called stalemate, meaning no negotiations, just...
So Kissinger was opposed to an agreement in 1971 between Egypt and Israel,
yes,
which would have led to the withdrawal from the Sinai.
Exactly.
Egypt would once again
now, the reason
have the Sinai, and there'd be a diplomatic relation between the two countries.
Yes, and that decided the matter. The way the U.S. goes sort of determines what happens. It's just overwhelmingly powerful. Now, when that led to a war...
73.
Yes, he kept saying, look, if you don't withdraw from the Sinai, there's going to be a war. Nobody believed him. Nobody took it seriously. When the war did come in 73, and it was a huge shock, it was a close thing for Israel after the U.S. ended up with a nuclear alert.
Exactly.
At that point, Kissinger recognized that that Egypt isn't a basket case. You can't just dismiss it. Then he began his shuttle diplomacy, and it goes on up to Camp David, finally, 78, 79. And at that point, the U.S. and Israel agreed to an offer that Sadat had presented in 1971, but the new one was harsher from the point of view of Israel and the United States than the original one.
To have been better off if you accepted 71 rather than the one that was negotiated.
Better off from their point of view, which
Carter,
I don't accept.
By Jimmy Carter, Camp David.
But in 71, there was nothing about the Palestinians. By 1977, the Palestinian issue was on the table. And the U.S. and Israel had to accept an offer which recognized in some fashion Palestinian national rights, which they didn't want to do. I mean, I think they should have done it, so I can't say it's worse, but they didn't want it. Now, it's interesting that this is described in the United States as a diplomatic triumph. In fact, it was a diplomatic catastrophe. If it had been accepted in 1971, it would have spared...
Jimmy Carter was here several days ago. I mean, he certainly thought it was a diplomatic triumph.
He probably doesn't know the history. I mean, you should have asked him whether he knows what happened in the background.
Well, if I'd had this interview before, I would have.
Well, it's all on the public record.
Yeah.
You know,
but
you know, this is one of the many things we have to learn about if we want to gain some understanding of what's really happening there. So when you ask questions about, say, Arafat, you know, unfortunately, all of this has to come in.
Okay, fair enough. But what's interesting now, let me Let me make this point. I spoke to someone about you today, and he said the following to me. Someone who many his views you would recommend, you would agree with, some not. He said to me that after complimenting your mind, the quality of the mind, and contributions you had made, he said that what you had done is turned American exceptionalism on its back. And that you're, for all those who believed in American exceptionalism, you had believed in exactly the opposite, whatever that is. And let me stay with this question. On the other hand, there are people who have asked you, look, if you have such strong feelings about how wrong-headed American policy has been, why don't you leave the country? A frequent sort of thing is thrown at people who are critical frequently. And you always say, I love this country.
Yeah, I sure do. Right. I mean, it's a very interesting question. I mean, let's try it on some other country. You know, it's sometimes easier to think about things clearly if we kiss and share bills. But let's go back to, say, the big enemy, Soviet Union.
Right.
I mean, the Russians would have been delighted to have the dissidents leave the country. If Sakharov had been willing to come to the West, they would have applauded. What, does it make sense to ask Sakharov, why don't you leave it, the Soviet Union?
I mean, I suppose... No, I'm not trying to answer that. You understand, I'm not asking that question. I'm actually using that question to make the point that you've always
that's
said...
That's the framework in which the question should be understood.
Right.
It's assuming that you can't have a democratic
society.
You stay
and fight for values because you love the country.
And you think that, you think that the country ought to live up to these values. And there are, you know, you can't rank countries A, B, C, D. Countries have all sorts of properties. There's a culture, there's a society, there's modes of interaction, and so on. A lot of the things that are simply achievements. Now, take, say, protection of free speech.
Right.
It's unique in the United States. There are a lot of great things that have been achieved. There are a lot of rotten things that have been done. If you have any concern about the country, meaning its people, its culture, and so on, you want to save and extend and amplify the achievements and modify the crimes.
And you would
crimes.
Put the protection of free speech high up on that list.
Very high. And it's not the only one.
Okay, well, tell me more, and then we'll come to some of the criticisms that you have made about American imperialism and the like.
See, we have to make a distinction between state power and a country. The different things.
I understand the difference. But
it's often not distinguished. If you criticize state policy, you're not criticizing a country.
I understand that, too. I mean, first of all, frequently when you're traveling around the world, as I do, you know, people say, I love, you know, America. I just have
hate the policy.
I hate the policy.
Sure. We're responsible for the policy. It's a free country. We can't say, you know, I don't have any responsibility for the policy, because we do. We may not know about it, but then we should find out about it. And if we decide we don't like it, we should change it. In fact, take a look at the question we've just been discussing, two-state settlement.
Right.
About two-thirds of the American population supports the international consensus on this, and long
which
has.
Which is, they ought to be a two-state solution.
Roughly the 67
right.
borders.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting to look at the polls. I mean, polls will, you find roughly two-thirds of the population saying, yeah, they support that. And roughly the same proportion says the U.S. ought to become more involved in the diplomacy. People don't know that that's a contradiction. The reason that that program has not been achieved is because of consistent U.S. intervention to prevent it from being achieved. And that continues at this very moment, in fact. Okay, it is a free country. We've got a lot of freedom. That means people have the opportunity to discover its work. You know, it's not going to come easily. It's where the Internet is helpful. They have the opportunity to discover the relevant facts and background, which should show them that their position is contradictory. They must come to understand what the U.S. government role has been over the years in preventing the outcome that they want.
Okay. Do you in the end then, if in fact, accept the premise that people get, for the most part in a democracy, people get the government they deserve?
No, I don't.
You don't?
No, in fact.
You don't, and you, because
not
you believe,
at all.
Well, let me finish. Because you believe the political process is corrupt.
It's not corrupt.
It's what?
Look.
Anybody says look to me, I know they're saying
it's not that simple.
Right.
I mean, it's not that there's robbery and stealing of elections. There is a distribution of power internal to the country. Enormous disparity of economic and other power. And that influences everything that happens in dramatic ways. So many issues simply don't come up in elections.
So the haves have more power than the have-nots, and therefore they're able to exercise it.
In fact, if you really look closely, elections, they restrict themselves to issues on which the population, they eliminate issues where the mass of the population opposes elite opinion systematically. And the population's aware of this.
Say that again, I'm sorry.
Well, let's take a concrete case,
right.
Okay? The year 2000 election, see? Among the issues that were highest in concern to the general population are things that roughly relate to the so-called trade agreements. So deficits, overseas investment, the transfer of jobs, you know, lots of topics like that. Did the right at that time, there was a plan for a an international hemispheric conference at Quebec, hemispheric summit, a few months later, which was intended to extend the NAFTA-type agreement to the whole hemisphere. Now, these are issues of enormous concern to
right.
people. Did it come up in the election? No. And there's a reason why it didn't come up in the election, and it's consistent. On those issues, the public tends to oppose policies on which there is an elite consensus, and therefore it doesn't come up in elections. Well, that's
okay,
part of the reflection.
But I mean, let me just make sure I understand. How do you stand yourself on the NAFTA agreement?
I agree with the general population. I think
agree with the general population whose view is?
Critical.
Critical.
And correct.
Because?
Because it's the wrong agreement. If you go back to 1990, 10 years ago, when the NAFTA agreement was coming along, there were serious critical analyses of it, which were in favor of a North American free trade agreement, but not this one. The analyses came from the labor movement. They came from Congress's Research Bureau, the Office of Technology Assessment. Pretty much the same analyses said, yeah, a North American economic agreement would be a good idea, but this one is designed as effectively an investor rights agreement. It privileges rights of investors and lenders, and it marginalizes the rights of people.
And were
but
you
it
worried,
could be done differently.
And were you worried about the loss of jobs and those kinds of issues that became a political football?
The
unions essentially were opposed to it.
That's the story, but it's not true.
I mean, in other words, you're saying that then they misled us when they made that argument?
No, the unions did not make
They
the
never
argument.
Made an argument that we were opposed because
they,
of jobs.
They mentioned that, but the labor movement had an official position. It was produced by the Labor Advisory Council along detailed analysis, and it was a very sensible position. It was never given, it never entered the media discussion. It was never given any publicity. The labor movement was accused of crude nationalism, this, that, and the other thing. That was not their position. Their actual position never made it to the public agenda.
And
same is true of Congress's own research bureau, which had a rather similar analysis. Yes, in favor of a NAFTA-style agreement, but not that one. It's kind of interesting that a few days ago, the Carnegie Endowment released an analysis of NAFTA, a fairly critical analysis. It was reported in the press, making some proposals as to how it should have been done. And those proposals, though they didn't say so, happened to be very similar to those that were proposed by the labor movement and Congress's Research Bureau 10 years ago, but didn't enter the political discussion, was not mentioned in the media, for example. Well, this is only one example of which there are numerous ones.
Basically saying that what you argue is that people are not getting the information they need to make wise choices.
They aren't, nor in fact are they given the choice. They aren't given the choice.
The choice between who are the two parties nominated in an election.
No, that they have, but the two parties represent essentially the same concentration of interests.
Concentration of economic power.
Look, the United States is essentially a one-party state. It has two factions of the business party. In fact, political science analyses of the nature of the U.S. party system by a fine political scientist at the University of Massachusetts, Tom Ferguson, is what he calls the investment theory of politics. Investors get together to invest to control the state.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's take two or three countries where you and I know, okay?
Yeah.
We have two parties in the United Kingdom, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have the Tory party and the Labour party. Would you say the same thing about them? Essentially?
It depends when. Today it's close to true.
Okay. In France, you have a socialist party and a, you know, the Chirac Gaullist party. essentially the same? I mean, not a whole lot of differences there. I mean, they have 35-hour week.
There are differences, but
in Spain we have Socialist Party. Yeah.
I would suggest we take...
Is any different in any of those countries in terms of how much difference there is between the two parties? Because let me make this argument with you and just get the... Essentially, in most countries, the battle in politics is for the center, is it not? In most places. Now, that doesn't
That's
mean
not
that...
True. That's simply not true. I mean, there are countries that have a much more lively democratic culture. So let's take a country that has a really lively democratic culture, much more than we do.
Like?
Brazil.
Okay.
Brazil is a rich, potentially rich, important country. In Brazil, something just happened recently which should humiliate us. They give us a real lesson in democracy. In Brazil, popular movements, large-scale popular movements, which had been developing over 20 years, reached a scale where they were able to elect a populist president over the opposition of highly concentrated capital and media concentration. Okay. We can't even dream of that.
Well,
that's a functioning democratic culture.
Let me stop you for a second. Let me just get a couple of questions in. Number one, I asked that question recently of Gary Wills was here. Mm-hmm. You know, why haven't we seen in the United States more success by a powerful coalition, essentially coming from the left, but not necessarily defined by what the conception, traditional conventional wisdom might be of the left, of labor, minorities, poor, black and white.
We have seen it.
What was it the last time you saw it?
A number of times. We saw it in the 60s. That's where the Great Society programs come from. We saw it in the 30s. That's where the New Deal comes from. And in fact, this is a battle that goes back to the origins of American history. You know, the original constitutional framework, the way Madison...
The author of the Great Society programs was Lyndon Johnson.
That's right. And the programs are not initiated by leaders. That's a serious misunderstanding.
Well, those programs were initiated primarily by people who actually, many of them who'd served with FDR.
See, that's a serious misinterpretation, I believe, of the way the political system works. Leaders may sign their names and they may push programs, but they do it because a popular constituency is compelling them to do it. That's the way changes take place. I mean, if there's a large-scale popular movement and there are pressures, there'll be somebody who'll say, I'm your leader.
You've made the Great Society...
And what happened in this... The programs that came out of the so-called Great Society were the result of popular ferment and activism and significant changes that were taking place in the 1960s, which very much democratized the society. And it led to these programs. Since then, there's been an enormous counterattack from business sectors trying to beat it back. And that's the course of history. You know, it's the same with the civil rights movement. It was the same with the labor movement.
But let me make this point by Lynn Johnson, because a lot of other things, and I want to say that we're 42 minutes in. We're doing an hour with you, and I want to invite you back, because inevitably people are going to say to me, you know, you could have gone for 2 or 3 hours, and you know, or they will say you interrupted too much, or they'll say a lot of other things. And I do want to hear from you. And I, you know, many people saw Lyndon Johnson, you know, as a man who was too beholden to economic interest, in terms of how he achieved his own wealth, and in terms of a whole range of things, whether it was Brown Root in Texas, or whether his relationship with a whole lot of institutions. But you were saying that he responded the way he did to Great Society programs having to do with medical care, having to do with poverty, having to do with a whole range of issues.
He responded
and
to
civil
public
rights
pressures.
Because the public pressure was
the
there.
The same was true of John F. Kennedy.
I'm willing to argue with you that Lyndon Johnson responded in part because that was where his heart was, and his sense of legacy in terms of what had influenced him.
Yeah.
You know?
And
secondly, some of the things that John Kennedy responded to, he saw his opportunity in history, in a sense, to show that he could get these things enacted, because that was his principal skill.
See, we're not disagreeing. We're talking about different topics.
Okay.
The topic that you're talking about is individual personalities. So the individual personality, Lyndon Johnson, what was going on in his mind. The topic that I'm talking about is how popular movements develop, create their own programs, press for them, finally often get somebody to initiate them. Those are different questions.
Okay, and I may agree with you, actually. I mean, I look with great interest in what's happening in Brazil.
Yeah. And here. It's happened here. Yeah. That's why do we have freedom of speech? I mean, freedom of speech is not in the Constitution. It's not in the Bill of Rights. In fact, up until the 1960s, in fact, the legal battles about freedom of speech are mostly in the 20th century. And there was no real legal protection for substantial freedom of speech, actually, until the 60s. In the 1960s, the Supreme Court finally, first in the course of the Civil Rights Movement, then later in the decade, finally realized a level of legal protection of freedom of speech that, to my knowledge, doesn't exist in any other country. And it's a large part of it grew out of the activism of the Civil Rights Movement.
Just to understand you, because I want to go to some things that are often attached to you and bring great controversy to you, other than freedom of speech, what else do you think is part of what America represents?
Yes. Represents.
Well, there's
a lot of things I like that are, I think, great about American life. For one thing, we have, compared with other societies, there's very little in the way of a kind of a caste system.
Yeah.
So people interact independently of social position. Yeah.
Is there a meritocracy?
There is in certainly in terms of policy formation. That's overwhelming. Yeah. But we're talking in terms of personal interaction. Are you? Mm. Does it matter whether what you do or that's what you do?
Yeah.
Well, these interactions among people, informal interactions, are, in my view, much healthier in the United States than other societies that I know. Now, those are important facts about a culture. Freedom of speech is not just a matter of law. It's a matter of being internalized, you know, realizing, understanding that's my right and I'm going to defend it. That's important. And the same is true of other rights. Actually, the United States has become a much more civilized society since the 1960s, just in our recent lifetimes.
Because, do you think?
Well, because of popular activism. Let's take women's rights. Was that an issue 40 years ago? No. Environmental issues, did they exist 40 years ago? No. Let's take something like opposition to aggression and violence. That attitudes on that have changed enormously. I mean, when John F. Kennedy attacked South Vietnam, as he did in 1962, direct attack.
You mean with assassination of Zimmer?
No. When the U.S. Air Force...
First sent their supporters.
See, I mean, there was so little opposition to this that no one even knows what happened. But if you look back at the record, the historical and documentary record, it's not controversial. Yeah. In 1962, Kennedy sent the U.S. Air Force to start bombing South Vietnam. They did it in South Vietnamese planes with Vietnamese markings, but it was U.S. pilots and U.S. equipment, thin cover. He authorized the use of napalm. He started the crop destruction programs to keep food from the indigenous rebels. Wait a minute, he started driving... Look, this is a war. Was there any protest?
No.
Okay, now that's changed.
Well, it may have been somebody wasn't significant.
Look, I can tell you because I was directly involved in
well,
it.
Well, we've got to know you because of your opposition to
you
Vietnam.
You couldn't get four people in a room to talk about
I'm not arguing about this.
But this is important about the country. It was 4 or 5 years before a significant a popular movement developed opposing an aggressive war against another country. Let's fast forward to today.
Right.
In this year, there were huge popular protests before the war was officially launched. That's a tremendous change in consciousness.
And why do you think that change took place? Because of the 60s? Because as it breathes, it gets wider and stronger and...
Change took place because a lot of people worked very hard to make it change place. The same is true of civil rights, of women's rights, of environmental issues, and so on. That's the way changes happen.
The same thing
happened in Brazil. Popular movements developed that way, not by some leader saying...
I agree with you on that. I'm not arguing that. But the interesting thing about Brazil now, you know, which is a worthy of a program here, and he is somebody that I've heard him speak and would like to see him at the table, he is disappointing some of his followers there because of some positions he's taking having to do with the rainforest and other issues.
You know why?
Why?
Because there are...
How come you know so much about everything?
Well, check it and see if it's right.
I'm not trying to persuade you or anyone else.
Here's what I think,
right.
And I think if you investigate this, what you'll find.
All right.
Over the last 20 or 30 years, in part as a reaction to the democratizing tendencies of the 60s, which were worldwide,
right.
They were dramatic here but also elsewhere, there's been a backlash. Part of the backlash, it's taken many forms. One of the forms it's taken is international economic arrangements, which are virtually designed to undermine democracy. Well, these, what's called in the rest of the world, neoliberal arrangements. Here it's called free trade, but it's not free trade. The array of international arrangements that's sort of formalized in the World Trade Organization. Those measures, if you look at them, it is well understood that they undermine democracy. One of the first measures that was taken in the early 70s, initially here, but then everywhere, was to free up flow of financial capital.
I need to move on because I got a few minutes. That's my point.
I won't try to explain anything, but let me just say that if you look at these arrangements, you'll find that they undermine democracy and they place countries in a stranglehold in which they cannot follow the policies of the overwhelming majority. And that's what's happening in Brazil, and that's why Lula's disappointing his constituency.
Okay, fine. I'll move on. I talked to someone else, knowing that you were coming in, and they said, you know, I was in Iraq recently, and I met no Iraqi who said the war was a mistake. Lots of them, in the idea of overthrowing Saddam, even now, and many of them wish the United States would leave, many of them have a terribly disappointed, upset, opposed to the way things are going. But this person, that I didn't meet anyone. Tell me how you feel about the use of American power in overthrowing Saddam. Was it because it violated your own sense of international law? Was it because that we didn't have, it wasn't a UN initiation?
I'm not going to be able to answer the question because the assumptions are wrong.
Okay, go ahead.
The United States was not in favor of overthrowing Saddam Hussein. In fact, George Bush made that explicit. At the Azores summit, a couple of days before the invasion started, Bush and Blair were there, and they issued a declaration in which Bush said, even if Saddam Hussein and his family leave the country, we're going to invade anyway. And in fact, that's consistent with a long-standing U.S. policy. You're right that every sane person in Iraq wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein, just like I have for 20 years, just like we all have, a murderous tyrant.
Right.
Why is he there? Why wasn't he overthrown? Or to ask another question, why do the majority of Iraqis, the published polls, Iraqis are asked, who's your favorite foreign leader? The favorite foreign leader of Iraqis, according to U.S.-run polls, is President Chirac of France, who was the symbol of opposition to the invasion. George Bush is far below, Blair even less below. Nevertheless, the same polls say, yeah, we're glad to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Well, if we want to think about this, we'll be able to figure out what's happening. Sure, they would like to get rid of Saddam Hussein. They would have liked to have gotten rid of him years ago. I mean, in 1991, they almost did get rid of him. But the U.S. supported Saddam so that he could crush the rebellion, which probably would have overthrown him. And we know why.
Well, I'm not sure they supported him so that he could
crush
the rebellion.
They effectively authorized him to crush the rebellion.
I'm not sure that many people... Let me make one point.
Yeah.
Is that, I mean, it clearly was a mistake. In 1991.
Well, was it a mistake?
Sure it was. To allow him to crush the rebellion. Yes, I do too.
Did George Bush think it was a mistake? No. Did Thomas Friedman of the New York Times think it was a mistake?
I can't speak for George Bush and Thomas Friedman.
Well, did the press think it was a mistake? I mean, just take a look back and look at the analysis.
And to allow him to have helicopters and be able to crush
Take a look at the analysis.
George Bush had asked to rise up?
Let's take a look at the analyses at the time. That's what we should be looking at. You can read it in, say, the New York Times, the most important newspaper in the world. Their analysis was, Alan Cowell, their Middle East correspondent, that much as we dislike the atrocities, there's an overwhelming consensus that Saddam Hussein offers more hope for the stability of the country, stability is a kind of technical word, stability of the country than the people who are trying to overthrow him. In other words, we'd rather have him than the people who are trying to overthrow him. Thomas Friedman, who was chief diplomatic correspondent, wrote, the best possible world for the United States would be an iron-fisted military junta ruling Iraq the same way Saddam Hussein did, much to the satisfaction.
Well, I'm sure. This I know Mr. Friedman, and I am sure he did not mean using the torture and
really?
Using the technique. Yes.
Then why did he say it?
Well, but he may very well have believed first of all, I'm leery of speaking for anyone like this,
right.
of George Bush or Tom Friedman, but he may very well have meant that Iraq, because of whatever fears he had, they would break up the balkanization of Iraq, and therefore it needed a Tito-like figure.
Let's say
he
Iraq.
May have meant that.
Let's say Iraq, but then, see, that means that from the point of view of U.S. policymakers and U.S. commentators, it wasn't a mistake. I think it was a mistake. You think it was
exactly.
a mistake, but they didn't.
Right.
The analysts and the policymakers thought it was right.
Well,
they
preferred.
Yeah. And then let's look at the next.
I bet you the neocons, who you find so much fault with in there, did not think it was a mistake.
Well, we don't know.
Wolfowitz of the world probably don't think it was a mistake.
Well, let's take a look at the Wolfowitz.
Not to have overthrown Saddam, because, they've been driven by overthrowing Saddam since 1991. You'll agree with that, won't you?
No, I don't.
That they haven't been driven by the notion?
It's just too narrow a question. Let's take a look at the Wolfowitzes of the world.
Okay.
He has a record, right?
Right.
His record is, for example, strong support of General Suharto, who is exactly...
When he served in Indonesia.
And afterwards, up until 1997, a couple of months before Suharto was overthrown, he was still praising him. Suharto was a mass murderer, probably worse than Saddam Hussein. He came into power killing a couple hundred thousand people. He ran a regime of vicious torture and oppression. He invaded East Timor, practically destroyed it. His torture and massacres were going on right to the end of his rule. Wolfowitz was praising him because of his contributions to the growth and development of Indonesia.
At that time, Wolfowitz served as ambassador to Indonesia.
This started when he was... in the State Department with responsibility for Asia, Southeast Asia in particular, he was as ambassador in Indonesia, and it continued through his post-government service. I think he was dean.
That's
only one example. As under his watch as State Department high official in the State Department with responsibility for Asia, the Reagan administration, under his watch, supported a whole range of murderous dictators, like Chun of South Korea. Supported him up to the end.
I'm not sure. I remember Chun, and I'm not sure when he came in and what he did. A whole series of American administrations supported a whole series of leaders in South Korea.
Absolutely, and Wolfowitz was in charge, almost in charge, second in command in the State Department, right up to the end. Marcos in the Philippines is another. Now, there are all kind of fake stories being concocted about this now, but I would urge people to go back to the original record and see what happened.
All right. This book, Noam Chomsky, Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance. We'll talk more about all these issues with him and others. I thank you for coming.
Great.
Pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Good.
Thank you for joining us. We went the hour. More to be said tomorrow night. Tony Marsden is here and others. See you then.